Morning and welcome back. Court now calls the case United States v. Harrington. I would note that Major Blythe and Major Christie, this is a repeat. We had you yesterday. I'm glad to see that you two are fully earning your 04 pay. Major Blythe, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Major Christie, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Prepared, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning again, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Efron, and members of the court. May it please the court. I'm Major Matthew Blythe, and together with Mr. Mark Ruger, we represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class Sean Harrington.
Major, can you speak up just a little bit?
You know, can you perhaps take the microphone and aim it more towards your face?
I know you're a tall guy, and the microphone's kind of short there, but.
Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to request 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. The unequivocal gravamen offense in this case was involuntary manslaughter. Airman Harrington faced sentencing for that offense, two minor drug use specifications, and communication of a threat. A threat which involved the intoxicated ramblings by text message to a friend and a roommate, and that failed to meet the objective and the subjective elements of the offense. Given the lopsided nature of the member's sentencing task, the military judge abused his discretion when he denied, and indeed believed he had to deny, requested instruction to inform the members of the maximum sentence by offense. That error, combined with the improper and powerful trial counsel-driven unsworn statement, led to the excessive 14-year sentence in this case, 4 years above the maximum for the gravamen offense. I'd like to begin with the analysis of...
Can I ask you a question? On page 46 of your brief, you say that the military judge's failure to instruct on the maximum offense, maximum sentence for each offense, that precluded defense counsel from making that argument. But you don't cite to anything in the JA, you don't cite to anything that the military judge said. Why would the military judge's refusal to give that instruction have precluded defense counsel from explaining to the panel?
Well, Your Honor, I think a fair reading of the military judge's ruling on that is precluding that the members should never have this information in front of them. And I don't know the mechanism for defense counsel just by themselves bring it before the members. I imagine that would have received a harsh rebuke from the judge and an instruction to ignore it. So I think a fair reading of the judge's ruling is that the members cannot have that information under the rules. And when we look at the military judge's analysis of his exercise of discretion, understanding it is broad, still, it has to be exercised in light of correct principles of law as applied to the facts and circumstances of the case. And here, the problem we have is this was a correct instruction requested by the defense. The military judge believed he was not allowed to do it under precedent under 1005E, but that is incorrect. It was a correct requested instruction under Gutierrez. That case, which although it was interpreting the 1969 MCM, it nonetheless was interpreting a provision that has simply moved within the MCM to the discussion section of RCM 1005E. And the point of that is the maximum punishment is the total of what's in the maximum punishment chart or the jurisdictional limit of the court-martial. And the court's predecessor in Gutierrez essentially said total there does not preclude the members from knowing by offense what the maximum punishment is. And in this case, the second step in the analysis is looking at was this substantially covered by the rest of the instructions? And it couldn't be, because in fact, the issue that they're trying to solve was the 20-year instruction, with members only knowing that for this entire case, the maximum punishment is 20 years.
Now, in terms of your analysis, you're not claiming that the military judge was required to give that instruction.
No, Your Honor, he was not.
So the military judge had discretion. Your point is he misunderstood the law and then misapplied the law because of that misunderstanding.
That's true, Your Honor, although the standard abuse of discretion test is slightly different in the instruction context with those three factors outlined in Miller. So I think it informs the analysis that he didn't understand the law, but still, in order for there to be error, it has to satisfy. Even if the judge misunderstood the law, it still would have to satisfy all three prongs, and we believe that it does.
Now, in terms of your reference to the prongs there, To what extent was the materiality and the quality of the evidence really based on the statements, the underlying statements of the victims as compared to the questions that were posed? From your viewpoint, are we supposed to view that as an indivisible unit, or when we're testing for materiality and quality, should we really focus on the questions separate from what was stated by the witnesses?
Well, I think the questions are inseparable because that reflects trial counsel's decisions on which questions to ask to generate certain responses, acknowledging that certain questions were open-ended and certain questions yielded narrative responses. There were still a number of questions where trial counsel was asking specific things that generated a certain response. We don't know in their interviews before the unsworn statement how they decided on what they would do, but it is indeed the trial counsel's decision to ask those questions that generates the response.
But was there we've had similar cases, was there anything in the statements of the victims that stands out to you as something that victims where you're the parents of a child who has been killed, where they would not have testified in that way? Or are you saying that's not your burden to prove?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's our burden to prove, but I think that the issue here is it is permissible. Everything they said would be permissible had they have done it of their own accord. But the problem is that it's funneled through the lens of what trial counsel decides is important to present to the members. Trial counsel making decisions on which questions to ask to generate certain responses.
And so, now, from your perspective, were any of those questions inflammatory?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that they were necessarily inflammatory. It's more that, as this Court has said before, it's not as though the victim's unsworn statement is a mechanism for trial counsel to, in essence, put words in the victim's mouth. Even if the victim could have said those things on their own, the fact that trial counsel is, in essence, stage managing the entire unsworn statement to generate that result is the problem.
Now, to use your words, if a victim's counsel were to stage manage the result, would that be permissible under the rules?
Well, Your Honor, I think the Cornelison Court, the Army Court, was incorrect in saying that a victim's counsel could under the rule, and I think the distinction lies in the language that the President used in 1001C versus 1001D for the accused. Under 1001C, the victim's counsel, for good cause shown, can deliver all or part. It's a better argument than trial counsel that they could participate, but still deliver connotes that they're speaking the statement on the behalf of the victim, as opposed to for the accused, the statement may be made by the accused, by counsel, or both.
But let's look at the victim's counsel and the victim's statements separate from that for a moment. Is there anything you can point to that would indicate that having a victim's counsel pose questions similar to those posed here by trial counsel is prohibited either by the rules or by any precedent of this court?
No, Your Honor. I think if victim's counsel, I think that the deliver language does not imply a question and answer session, but if this court disagrees, it would be permissible for the victim's counsel to do what the trial counsel did here.
So the distinction you're drawing is that by having the trial counsel do it, this exalts those statements into essentially being similar to testimony as reflected by the fact that they provided their statements from the witness stand and the military judge thanked them for their testimony, mistakenly?
That's part of it, Honor. Those factors, the fact that it happened on the witness stand and that the father was thanked for his testimony, kind of cements the impression that this is the government controlling the evidence to be provided, and this court's consistent holdings about the control of the victim unsworn statement. It is the victim's statement. It's not for the trial counsel to take control of any part of it. And so while the victim's counsel, on behalf of the victim, could conceivably do the same thing if question and answer were permitted there, that does not mean that the trial counsel would have the same right to step into the shoes. And the starting point for that analysis is that the rule simply doesn't apply there. The rule does not mention trial counsel at all, where for an accused, as I mentioned before, it's crystal clear the President knows how to provide the right to do a question and answer session. For the accused, it's made by accused, counsel, or both. That's absent from the victim's unsworn statement. So there's simply no provision for trial counsel to be involved under the rule. That's consistent with this court's holding in Barker and Hamilton, where it explicitly stated under the procedure, at that time 1001 capital A, that there was no provision for anyone but the victim, the victim designee, or victim's counsel to participate in the victim's unsworn statement.
Counsel, can we go back? I'm not sure I caught your answer to part of the Chief's question about if this was done. I understand your argument that the trial counsel shouldn't have been permitted to participate in any way. The rules don't permit it. But his question about, well, what if a special victim's counsel had been the one engaging in the Q&A with the victim, would how would we analyze the potential prejudice? Can we parse the, I think you've said, admittedly fine statements by the victim from the questions by the special victim's counsel, or do we have to analyze the entire statement as a pack, as a unitary package?
Yes, sir. And I think, if I phrased it poorly, but I think it has to be analyzed together because the victim's statement is a byproduct of the questions the trial counsel chose. They could have said those things by themselves, but because they didn't, because it happened by virtue of trial counsel taking control, they are collectively the questions and the answers part of the improper unsworn statement.
Now, do you think there's any issue with a victim sitting down and saying, I don't know what to say, and they go to the special victim's counsel and they say, what am I supposed to put in this document? Say it's going to be written instead of delivered orally, or they're going to write it out and then read it on the stand. Is there any objection in the rule? Is there any problem in the rules with them going to the special victim's counsel and say, what kind of things should I put in my statement?
Not at all, Your Honor. I mean, the special victim's counsel has full rights to advise their client on the content of the unsworn statement, so there would be no concern with that at all. But it would be a concern if the victim goes to the trial counsel, and the trial counsel, in essence, composes the statement there, and that's akin to what happened here, is that trial counsel asks questions to generate certain conduct.
Were the statements leading?
Many of them were not, Your Honor. Some of them were. They're asking about specific moments. For instance, with the mother, he's asking about whether she speaks to her son every day, asks her to comment on two specific prosecution exhibits. With the father, asks if the son still plays tricks on him. And so some questions that are clearly designed to elicit a certain response, that the assumption is that they had an interview about this and they're trying to generate certain things. This is not the kind of questions that you would ask on a clean slate. It's because they knew these are the things that we want to generate through the questioning, and they did so. And when assessing prejudice from the error, I mean, the natural comparison is with the Edwards case. And here we have some very similar parallels to draw. One of the important ones is on the way the trial counsel used it, acknowledging that the trial counsel here did not use it as extensively as the trial counsel in Edwards. But at the crescendo of the case, at the peak of the sentencing argument, at the time when the circuit trial counsel is making an emotional charge for the members to go sentence him, she invokes, remember the parents. Remember what they told you up on the stand. Remember what they've lost when you sentence him to at least 15 years of confinement. So that's some evidence that that unsworn statement, the improper unsworn statement, is what the trial counsel wants the members to think about when they sentence him to 15 years. The separate problem with that is that she's asking them to think about the parents when they sentence him to at least 5 years more than they otherwise could for that underlying offense. Another distinction from Edwards is here, the government received almost the entire sentence they asked for. They received 14 years when asking for 15. In Edwards, the sentence was 35 years when the maximum was life without the possibility of parole.
Counsel, can we talk about the sentence specifically with respect to the second issue? Let's assume we agree that the instruction was proper and denying it was an abuse of discretion. In your brief, you say that the sentence was plainly that the prejudice is shown because the sentence by the sentence itself, that the sentence was plainly excessive. But of course, you had a sentence review at the CCA, and they could determine whether or not there was error here, whether the sentence was excessive. I mean, is that the only ground? And I'm just wondering also, if we agreed with that and we told the CCA to reassess the sentence, what would they do?
Well, Your Honor, and we would ask if this court does rule in our favor that it would be a rehearing rather than a reassessment, because we have deep concerns that the Air Force Court did not find this sentence inappropriately and severe. The analysis was about a paragraph. It didn't mention the concerns that we raised, in part because it found there was no error in the instructions, but still, I think this was, would have been a ripe case for inappropriately severe sentence determination in light of the fact that 10 years, looking at the actual numbers, 10 years was the maximum punishment for involuntary manslaughter. That was 90% of the litigated trial. 7 years was for the two drug offenses, which are generally by themselves wouldn't even be at a general court-martial. Just so in terms of the scope of what the likely sentence would be, and the maximum sentence for the communication of a threat was 3 years. And so one of the points from the legal sufficiency analysis of the first issue is this was not the worst communication of threat out there. The drug offenses were relatively minor. And what he ends up getting is 14 years of confinement. And for the prejudice from the instructions, we can look at the interaction the judge had with counsel. Defense counsel firmly raised this to the judge, said, we don't know what the government's going to ask for, but we are worried that the members are going to think 15 years is an acceptable sentence for involuntary manslaughter. And I'm reading between the lines, but the military judge seemed fairly nonchalant that, well, in fact, they can, is what he said. He didn't seem concerned with the idea that they might sentence 15 years just for the involuntary manslaughter, or primarily based on the involuntary manslaughter. While that's permissible under unitary sentencing, it's a deeply problematic outcome in a lopsided case like that, like this, and that's why it was an abuse of discretion for the military judge to deny.
How could you ever know that that's what the members did? In other words, how could you ever know that the members decided to use 15 years to apply it all to the involuntary manslaughter and not consider the other two kinds of offenses?
Yes, sir. I don't think that we can know what they calculated, but the point of raising the issue, and Chief, I see that.
Please proceed.
Yeah, I guess that's my point, is that you would never know that. And so you're trying to address a problem for which the answer could never be known. In other words, we can never know whether that's what the members, and it would be pure speculation that that's what they would do. Would you agree or not?
Mr. Your Honor, I don't have a way of pointing to somewhere specific in the JA that would indicate the members weighed one thing or another. What we can look to is the way the case was argued, the way that the trial counsel almost exclusively emphasized involuntary manslaughter in the sentencing argument.
Because ultimately, aren't the members told, and in this case, like all cases, what the maximum is?
They are, Your Honor, for the 20 years. They were appropriately instructed that was the cap, but again, in a case like this, where the gravamen offense has a maximum punishment that's the same as all the other specifications combined that were relatively minor, it was an abuse of discretion not to provide them the context to be able to make the determination in light of all of the available sentences.
Additional questions from the bench?
If I could just flag one for consideration during rebuttal, and I'll also ask the government, saying, given the text of 1001 dealing with statements that are made by the victim, is it permissible to have counsel engage in a question and answer dialogue with the victim under the rule when the victim is making a statement? Or does the rule limit the role of counsel to either counseling the victim on what to say in his or her, say in his or her own statement, or the counsel making the statement on behalf? Does it provide an opening for this unsworn question and answer?
Yes, sir. And did you want me to respond now or after or during rebuttal?
For the Chief Judge.
It's up to
sure.
Yes, sir. Well, I think the language of the rule here doesn't allow for trial counsel to have a role in that. I think the victim certainly has the right under Article 6B to confer with the government.
I wasn't referring to trial counsel, any counsel. Can any counsel be used to do a question and answer dialogue with a victim under the rule?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the victim's counsel, I still think that they would not be permitted under the rule because the text of the rule says they're allowed to deliver all or part of the statement as opposed to, for the accused, it says made by. But I think at least there's a stronger argument there that the victim's counsel could compared to the trial counsel who cannot under the rule.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any further questions from the bench? Thank you. Major Christie.
Chief Judge Olson, and may it please the Court, I'm Major Morgan Christie, and along with Major Brittany Spears, I represent the United States. Appellant urges this court to do three things. Divorce his threats from context, endorse a confusing and misleading instruction, and narrowly interpret a victim's right to be heard. This court should reject that invitation for three reasons. First, threats take their legal color and quality from their surrounding circumstances. Second, no court has ever held a military judge abused his discretion in failing to give the instruction appellant requested. And third, trial counsel facilitating an unrepresented victim's right to be heard is not unreasonable within the meaning of Article 6B because the rule is silent on unrepresented victims. Drawing every reasonable inference from the evidence in favor of the prosecution, a reasonable fact finder could have found that appellant threatened the victim. He sent her a barrage of erratic and angry text messages. He threatened to kill whatever sick, sadistic person hogtied him. He incessantly interrogated the victim about who hogtied him and claimed he'd go easy on her if she told him. He described himself as dead serious, and less than 30 minutes later, when the victim came home, he was waiting with a gun. Immediately, there was a reanimation of his agitation as he told the victim, "I'll give you one more chance to tell me who you sent to the house," while simultaneously brandishing a gun.
Now, explain to me how the later incident involving the firearm on the bar stool, how we can attribute that to the text message threats in terms of that specific offense, that isolated offense.
Because appellant himself made the connection between the gun and the earlier threat as he logically connected the two on the exact same subject matter. The very first thing he said to the victim while brandishing the gun was referencing back that conversation about who hogtied him. And it was when the victim saw the gun, she testified, the text suddenly became real. It just clicked that appellant meant business, and that's when she backed up, freaked out, and screamed.
So, temporally, how great of a time distinction can there be here? What if purported threats are made on day one? The intended victim of those threats, so to speak, doesn't interpret that as a threat. And then some distant point in the future, the accused does or says something that causes the victim to suddenly realize those threats might have been serious. That's permissible in your viewpoint?
Your Honor, a temporal bright-line rule is unworkable because at some point it will certainly become too attenuated. It's so fact and circumstance dependent, it's really difficult to announce a temporal requirement. So instead of a temporal proximity requirement being the governing rule, and here we're dealing with less than 30 minutes, the rule should be that it is the facts and circumstances. So we already have a limit. It's a relevancy standard under MRE 401. That later conduct has to be relevant evidence, and then the military judge has to do a 401, 403 analysis to determine if that evidence comes in.
So your position is at the time the threats are uttered, either orally or in writing, that the intended victim doesn't have to perceive them as threats. Later, they can contextualize them to perceive them as a threat?
Yes, Your Honor, because this court has never announced a contemporaneity requirement for this. If we look to the text of the rule and it speaks about a present determination, this court has held that it can look to the surrounding circumstances to determine if a supposed threat was actually a joke. And if a court can look to later in time facts and circumstances to undermine the seriousness of the threat, then so too should this court be able to look to those facts and circumstances to bolster the seriousness of a threat. If I say, "I'm going to kill you," and then literally 1 second later I say, "Ha ha, just kidding, I'm not going to do that." Well, technically that joke has occurred 1 second later, so there's no longer a present determination or intent. surely that mechanical application isn't the right answer. If I threaten you and then I say, but wait, there's more, naturally you'd want to know the context. In a hearsay context, for example, when we're looking at present sense impression, it's not strictly limited to the moment something is uttered. Rather, the MRE allows for statements made while or immediately after an event. And this court has never imposed a direct overlap requirement. And so when we look to the cases that appellant cites for seemingly to imply this contemporaneous requirement, Gutierrez, Nicola, and Rosario, in Rosario, this court actually looked to multiple acquitted sexual contact instances that happened both before and after the convicted sexual harassment and found that that acquitted context lent support to the sufficiency of the harassment conviction. The literal words appellant uttered are certainly the starting point for analysis, but not the end, because context gives meaning to literal statements.
In this particular case, can you look at just the words, just the text, and determine what a reasonable person might have, how the reasonable person might have interpreted them? I mean, is it not that what the victim actually perceived here is not important, but is it less relevant when the standard is what a reasonable person, how a reasonable person would have interpreted the text when they read them, given all the facts and circumstances, and not move to the later point that the chief judge just raised? Can you look at just the statement, the text, in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. A rational fact finder could have looked at just the words that were charged in the specification and not considered the brandishing the gun and found, drawing every reasonable inference in favor of the prosecution, that it met all of the elements.
Could they exclude the relevant, but maybe, the relevant point that the victim herself at the time she read the text did not perceive it as a threat?
No, Your Honor, I don't think they should have excluded that, because the victim, although we look at the first element of a threat, it is a reasonable person standard. As long as the words uttered that a reasonable person could have felt wrongfully threatened, that would suffice. But I think, in all fairness, the fact that the victim subjectively at the time only thought that the appellant was high and kind of coming down from a drug high is some measure of the reasonable person standard, but it's not dispositive.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Counsel, did the testimony at trial have the victim identify the specific words that were used in the text when the question arose as to whether she felt threatened or came to a realization about feeling uncomfortable with the situation? Do we have something in the record that says those particular words were the ones that concerned me?
No, Your Honor. The direct examination is not that clear. The text messages were admitted as a prosecution exhibit, and she was certainly asked generally about the content of the messages and then the brandishing of the gun, but there was no question directly on point which aspect of these text messages was what caused you to be afraid of him. And nor should that be required, Your Honor, because it is a totality of the circumstances. And the test for legal sufficiency isn't whether the evidence is better read one way or another. It's whether any reasonable fact finder reading the evidence one way could have found all the elements of a threat beyond a reasonable doubt, and they certainly could.
But in a situation where you have the testimony from the witness indicating there was no, at that time, hearing those words, no concern about them in terms of a threat, and later on there are words of testimony about the text in general, why would we not require, and it's not a rhetorical question, the later information to be tied specifically to the words that are the subject of the charge?
Because, Your Honor, this court has never divorced words from their surroundings. This court has always looked to the impact of the literal words that are uttered to divorce them from the facts and circumstances that happened less than 30 minutes later is illogical and unnatural.
I understand that. Following that, though, that is not divorcing the words from the context. Here we have a context in which the witness is saying, I just thought he was high, didn't feel threatened. Later on, something in the text was connected to the incident that happened and then made her feel threatened. How do we know which words in the text were in her mind at that point?
We don't know which texts were in her mind at that point, Your Honor, because the two text messages were charged in a single specification, and because the members did not come back with findings by exceptions and substitutions, that means that they accepted that both of those threats met the requisite elements for communicating a threat.
But they weren't the only words that were in the text.
Correct, Your Honor.
There were lots of other words in the text.
Yes, Your Honor.
So how do we know that the witness was referring to those specific words in the second statement when something in the text now is transformed into a threat?
Your Honor, there's nothing specific to the victim herself linking those two. But if we look at what a reasonable person would have perceived, which is the objective test under the first element of an Article 134 communicating a threat, a reasonable fact finder could have found that a reasonable person would have felt threatened when someone says, I am going to kill whatever sick, sadistic person hogtied me, and you better tell me who that person is.
Thank you.
And pending any other questions on Issue 1, I'd like to move to Issue 2, Chief Judge.
Any other questions on this first issue? Please do.
Thank you. A military judge has substantial discretionary power.
Let's just jump in. So, in rejecting the request for the instruction, the military judge said, members are never instructed on what a specific maximum punishment is for each offense. Why isn't that, under Gutierrez, just a straight-up misstatement of the law?
Because, Your Honor, the military judge rooted his analysis in the plain language of the rule, in RCM 1000.
Okay, you're going to have to walk me through that language, because I don't see any plain language in the rule that prohibits a military judge from giving that instruction.
Yes, Your Honor. The language of RCM 1002B made clear at the time that a court-martial may not impose separate sentences, but only...
What specific language prohibits that? It certainly requires that the military judge instruct what the total is, but what is the language in the rule that prohibits the military judge from telling them what the maximum is for each offense?
Nothing per se prohibits it, Your Honor. And so when we read the military judge's analysis, he did not say, I am prohibited from giving this. He did not say, the rule says I have no legal authority. What he said is he correctly stated what the RCM said and then added.
He says are never instructed. Is that a correct statement?
It is a correct statement.
It is. Oh, didn't Gutierrez, didn't that cite a bunch of cases where those instructions were given?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I saw the question, was that a correct statement from the record?
Right. No, I'm sorry.
Yes,
is that a correct statement? That they are never given?
No, Your Honor. There is one case, Gutierrez, in 1981, where even though the military judge did not give that instruction, this court's predecessor didn't conclude that advising the members on individual maximum sentences was required or even advisable, just that it was prohibited by law at the time. But in the last 41 years since Gutierrez, no case has cited it favorably for that proposition.
But is it not still good law?
It is still good law. It has limited presidential value, and when given...
Why? Because it's old?
No, Your Honor. Because it does not stand for the proposition that because that military judge was not precluded from giving the instruction, that does not mean, ipso facto, this military judge abused his discretion by failing to give the instruction. Abuse of discretion is a wide range of choices.
Right, but if he misunderstood the law, doesn't that satisfy an abuse of discretion?
It does, but I don't think he misunderstood the law, Your Honor. He said that Purdy was a little bit of legal authority to back up the court's thoughts on that. And when he said that Purdy was another way of saying we don't instruct on various segments of the punishment. He didn't say that he was per se prohibited to do it, but that in our practice, our courts don't do that, which is entirely accurate under a unitary sentencing system.
Did he give some other explanation why he didn't want to do it? If he believed he had discretion, did he give some explanation for why he was declining to do it?
Yes, Your Honor, that it was confusing to the members to instruct on that, because the defense did not oppose a follow-up instruction that said, even if these are the individual components of the total sum, I hereby instruct you that we employ unitary sentencing. So, in essence, disregard. That instruction is, in essence, rooted in jury nullification. And when the military judge point-blank asked the defense, I will give you the opportunity, please cite me to precedent, cite me to case law or authority that supports the proposition, the defense had none. So given the information that the military judge had at the time, what was squarely before him, he did not abuse his discretion in failing to give an instruction that would have, in essence, been a nullity if he had to turn around and tell the members, now disregard that instruction I gave you because you're now to employ a unitary sentencing system. And a military judge has an affirmative obligation to shield members from confusing and misleading information.
Counsel, can you turn to the issue of prejudice? You know, appellant's point is that it was misleading in a particular case to give the maximum sentence when one offense was so much more severe than the other. And just to change the facts a little bit, I think there was testimony in this case that the accused had used marijuana 15 times. Let's suppose he had one speck of manslaughter and 15 specks of using marijuana. Well, that would make the maximum sentence, if I'm doing the math right, 10 years plus another 30 for the marijuana usage of 40 years. It just seems that they can't point to anything more than it seems excessive, but it does seem a little odd in a case like that to assume that there wouldn't be prejudice if you told somebody that the maximum sentence is 40 years.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, because not all drug uses are created equal. This wasn't a one-time marijuana use. For 2 years, appellant used two different types of drugs about 20 to 30 times. And military courts have a lengthy history of acknowledging the seriousness of drug crimes. It's been called a plague on our military society. And not all threats are created equal. He didn't just threaten the reputation of the victim or threaten to do bodily harm. He threatened to murder another airman when he had the means to follow through with it, a gun. That's about as serious as you get. And any concerns about the appropriateness of that sentence were best left to the CCA in performing their unique Article 66 role.
But is the issue in this case sentence appropriateness under Article 66? Or, assuming that there's error, and recognize that you're not conceded, but assuming that there was error in failure to give the requested instruction, is that determined by sentence appropriateness, or are there other factors that go into prejudice that look into the specific circumstances of the case and the dynamic of the sentencing authority considering the impact of having the information presented that wasn't presented?
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly this court could look to a prejudice analysis in Article 56 and look at the evidence that was in front of the fact finder, because the prejudice is speculative. The members could have returned the exact same sentence. They could have even returned a sentence that was 6 years more than what they returned. Trial counsel could have asked for the exact same ask, and it wouldn't have been, and that would have been appropriate. Additionally, if this was something to be raised to the fact finder's attention, I do agree that defense counsel couldn't argue this as a matter of law to the members if it wasn't instructed on, because that assumes facts are law, not in evidence. But the accused presented an unsworn statement, and he certainly could have attached that information to his unsworn statement if he wanted that to be before the fact finder. And pending any other questions, I see I have 35 seconds, Your Honor. May I at least make a few points on the third issue?
Check.
Can I ask you a question first?
Please.
Jumping to the third issue, what authority was there for the trial counsel to participate in the presentation of the victim's unsworn statement?
Your Honor, RCM 1001C, because it is not immediately plain, because it is silent on an unrepresented victim's mode of presentation. So the rule doesn't address it, but it doesn't expressly prohibit it either. And surely the president didn't intend for unrepresented victims, like the parents of a dead service member, to be deprived this mode of presentation. And so because the rule is unclear...
Why wouldn't we assume? There's a specific provision permitting special victims councils to present on behalf of the victims, and maybe that does or maybe that doesn't include the ability to engage in a Q&A. But if there's no, if it provides that for special victims councils and it's silent as to everybody else, why would we assume that the president intended to give that authority to anyone else?
Because it's a fundamental canon of construction that the rule must be read with a view to its place in the overall statutory scheme. And so to harmonize RCM 1001C with Article 6B, it's grounded in the statutory right, and there's nothing in Article 6B or its legislative history that suggests Congress intended to arbitrarily restrict an unrepresented victim or a victim's representative in their mode of allocution. The only holistic reading that's compatible with Article 6B is that a military judge, in exercising his gatekeeping function, may permit an unrepresented victim to present an unsworn statement facilitated by trial counsel.
And do you agree that the trial counsel participated in the presentation of the unsworn victim statement?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. You're going to have to define. What is your definition of participate that leads you to give that answer?
Your Honor, I believe we had it in the brief that a trial counsel is taking an active role in shaping, so in this case it would be taking an active role in shaping the content of that. But counsel's questions are not evidence.
Am I participating in this oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor, you are.
Okay. Then what's the difference?
The difference is if there was a rule that said that Your Honor's questions were not evidence and only my answers under oath were evidence, then that's the distinction. Also,
is any of an unsworn victim statement evidence?
No, Your Honor. But it's a governing rule. Also, this court asks primarily leading questions to counsel, and that is very different than open-ended, perfunctory questions.
Okay, but that doesn't get into whether or not she participated, right? If we believe the trial counsel participated and that participation wasn't authorized under the rule, is that an error?
That would be an error then, Your Honor, yes. And then we would have to look at prejudice, and in this case, there is not prejudice when the content of the parent's statements were cumulative of the brother's unsworn statement, prosecution exhibits, and even the accused's unsworn statement himself.
Further questions from the bench?
Could the president provide in the rule that counsel for a victim can make a statement in the form of a question and answer, an unsworn statement in the form of question and answer with the victim?
He certainly could, Your Honor.
And has the president done that?
He has not, Your Honor.
So in this case, is the trial counsel the only person under the rules that the military judge could find to make that presentation?
No, Your Honor.
Could the military judge have appointed a designee to either make the statement or attempt to arrange for counsel to assist?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was that done here?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you. Major Bly.
Thank you, Judge Olson. I just want to start with the instruction at JA 275. Members are never instructed on what a specific maximum punishment is for the individual offense. The military judge just didn't understand the law. And with regard to the prejudice on the instruction, it's a preserved error, so I think it's normal harmless error analysis, and it's not our burden to prove there was prejudice there. Shifting over to legal sufficiency, we agree with the government on the importance of context in the case, but one important distinction from what the government said, it's a reasonable person in the recipient's place. And that's what this court said in Phillips. So who is that person? Well, it's a roommate, it's a friend. It's someone who the kind of things that you would text to a roommate or a friend are different than what a reasonable person in another context is going to understand them to mean. So in that context, looking at what those words would mean to her in that context is important. And it's some indication that even though she doesn't have to be afraid in order for the offense to be complete, it's some indication of what a roommate would think in that situation, that she thinks very little of it. In her own words, at the time, she just thought he was coming down from being high. It's not until later in the night where she says, all of a sudden it clicked, and it means something different than it meant before.
Counsel, why is that not a factual sufficiency question for the CCA to address? That is, the witness, roommate, timing issue. Why is that? Why does that? What makes that become an issue of law as opposed to an issue of fact for the court-martial initially and the CCA on review to decide for factual sufficiency?
Yes, sir. It's our position that those text messages read in light, no reasonable fact finder could read those text messages in light of their relationship to conclude that he had either the subjective intent to communicate a threat or that an objective recipient in her position would perceive those as a threat. And looking at the specific language, after he's purported to have just threatened to kill somebody and do something less to her, the next thing he's asking about is who took a bath. And so it kind of betrays that there's not actually an intent to communicate a threat there.
Counsel, can you articulate a legal rule that pretend you're writing the, let's say you win, we find for you that here it wasn't legally sufficient. What would we say, what would the Westlaw headnote say, that in a case where this circumstance occurs, that's insufficient for there to be a threat? Like, what is the generally applicable rule that was violated here that would make a difference going forward?
Well, I don't think we'd have to expand much beyond what this court said in Browner and Phillips, that in essence it is looking based on the recipient, someone in the shoes of the recipient, would they perceive that as a threat? And so I don't think it requires a new rule of law here. It's just the application to the facts here. I think the Air Force Court in its analysis gave short shrift to that, but I think the context here is critical. It's not just a reasonable person. It's a reasonable person in the recipient's place. And again, I think the Phillips case said that explicitly. I think that would be the rule that would apply here and should be sufficient to find the evidence legally insufficient. With regard to transferring intent, that's in essence the Nicola, Rosario, and Gutierrez cases. They're not about that. What we're talking about here is looking into the future to decide what someone meant in the past, and that's fraught with danger for the reasons we talk about in our brief. And there's no case that's done that. The only case on point is the Hall case, which Navy published case that decided not to look into the future to determine what something meant. Barring any questions, I say my
Any further questions? Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and this court will be in recess until further order of the court.